Hey everyone, welcome to another exciting episode of the Scratch Track Podcast presented by the Dude and Grim Show and co-produced by Mr. IVEST. I'm the Dude.
And I am Grim, and today we are going to be discussing Blur, the self-titled album by the band
Blur.
Blur. And depending on where you're at, my hand may have looked like a blur when I swooped it by real quick. I'm not there myself, but...
I'm definitely going to make sure that for the thumbnail, we're out of focus.
Oh, yeah, I would. I would definitely. It's also, you know, it's also a really great tool in Photoshop.
the Gaussian blur.
Yeah.
Gaussian blur. I feel like this is one of the first CDs I ever probably bought, maybe even with my own money.
Oh, really?
You
would have been what? 15 years old?
15.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. 15. Well, oh, just turned 15. Released February 10th. Wow. Okay. I mean, it's weird. It was weird to read, actually, that this is their fifth studio album.
I know, because there was just so little visibility to them in the U.S.
Yeah.
And granted, we were younger, too. But this is all really... Not to say the internet didn't exist, but not in the way it does now. We're just like the spread of information about anything, but especially for those of us who are into music, that just, you can find out so much in a little amount of time, where back then you would have had to really like dig into publications and go to record stores specifically looking for like imports or something, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the way we absorbed music back then was still, you know, it was MTV and the radio, you know, and even it, I found it interesting. Like, I didn't know Beetlebum was even like the first single.
Yeah. Because
the first thing that I ever heard was Song 2.
Yeah. Like, that's just the first thing just I heard. Anybody heard in the U.S. I read an interview with Damon Albarn about, I mean, a lot of things he's done, but it talked about Blur, and it said that the interviewer mentioned that, you know, what are your thoughts in retrospect of Song 2, you know, being what finally broke you guys in America? And he was like, ugh, that song. That was like all he said.
yeah. I mean, I feel like with a lot of bands, you know, when they have that, it's just like a blessing and a curse. Just like Radiohead with Creep. It's just like, ugh. Yeah. Like, you know, play the same song. Like, it's just after a while, you know, it's what brings you to that next level. At the same time, man, you got to. That's what people want to hear. You got to keep playing it.
I know.
And, you know, and they broke over here. And I remember hearing that song a ton. Dude, I had World Cup, like FIFA 98 for my Sega. And that was like the when you turned the game on, that was the song that played. Man.
Oh, wow. Like, it was solid just like royalties, I bet.
Yeah, I know. It was just so, so big at that point.
You know, I don't know if I had this CD. I know you and several other of, like, friends that I would hang with all the time did. So I listened to it, and Beetlebum always stuck with me. And Ballad of a Sad Country Man, or Country Ballad Man, Sad Ballad Man. Like, those songs actually stuck with me a lot more than even Song 2, but Song 2 was just, you know, was always in there anyways, thanks to MTV. But yeah, you were, I mean, MTV was really, because at that point, it wasn't just like a greatest hits album of how shitty society has gotten. They used to like play music videos then, and it was cool. Right.
Right. Yeah.
And absolutely. So you did hear about new bands, not necessarily underground bands, but if a band was going to break and they were going to be big, you would know about it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And they, you know, it was kind of interesting to read that sort of their, I guess, their demographic, you could say, before these first four albums, they talked about it was a lot of just girls. And like they at their shows, the first 10 or 15 rows would be like these screaming girl fans and everything. And
well, yeah, because I guess they really started that whole Britpop thing, which, again, didn't really know that much about.
Yeah. And when they came out with this album, even they, well, one, they're just growing up and becoming like actual adults in the, you know, in the world. And so I think after, you know, you can only go for so long kind of like, I wouldn't say making the same thing, but being like, oh, you know, we want to really step outside of the box here.
Yeah.
And I feel like in a way they almost did with this album, kind of what Nirvana did with In Utero. They were just kind of like, yeah, we're going to go in the complete opposite direction. Yeah. We're going to make something just completely different. And for me, I didn't appreciate that at the time because, again, I had no
concept of what they were before.
What they were before.
Yeah, it was just like another good record from like a British alternative band, you know?
Yeah. I think for the longest time, I figured this was their
debut.
First album. Yeah. Just because it was, you know, a lot of bands will do especially back then, a self-titled album as just, hey, that's the name of our first album and everything. You know, I'm trying to think. I'm sure there's plenty of them out there, but I'm trying to think of like other bands that have put out their self-titled album, but it's like not, it's like in the middle of their catalog.
Well, you know? Fleetwood Mac did that. Actually, no, it wasn't in their middle. They had two self-titled albums. Did it
twice.
Yeah. It's so awesome. Yeah, like, you know, that first one, it really needed a little more oomph. So let's give it another go.
Did Bowie do that too?
I think he actually did because there was the David Bowie album and then there's the David Bowie album that, you know, that has like
Space Oddity,
Oddity. Yeah. And a lot of times the album's called Space Oddity, but I do think it's technically self-titled.
Yeah. So interesting, man. You know, I think we did get a little bit of wind over here. Once Blur kind of broke through and, about sort of the rivalry with Oasis, like that did come more to MTV, but until Blur kind of blew up and made it to MTV, we didn't really,
knew of Oasis or maybe, I don't know what year was Morning Glory. I think it was before this, wasn't it?
I think it was, I want to say it was 95 because that's when they had the British Heavyweight Championship because Roll With It, I believe, is on Morning Glory, right?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah, and so that's what Country House, and Country House beat out Roll With It by Oasis. I guess in the first week it sold more copies or
Now there's a good episode of Disgraceland, the podcast that I really like, that talks about Oasis, and they kind of talk about this feud, and that's something I want to talk about because like many would argue how it's been widely speculated that more of the feud between Notorious B.I.G. and Tupac Shakur was hyped up by the media than it actually existed in and of itself. This is like a similar thing where it just became something to sell newspapers. And it seems like, I think you had mentioned that, like, the band really didn't want anything to do with it.
Yeah, I can't speak for Oasis, but in the Blur documentary, they just seemed like they were just like kind of like, yeah, like, you know, that was not, we didn't do that. You know, we you know, whether there was. Yeah, I mean, and I think it was Damon even said, like, you know, as a band, you know, when you're in a band, there is sort of a competitive nature to it and everything. And, you know, I guess I can imagine wanting to be number one, right? Wanting to outsell. And then, you know, of course, then if you got your fellow countrymen, right? And there is sort of that, you know, you want to be number one and everything. But as far as, I don't know, as far as like them really wanting to be a part of it, I mean, I'm sure they wanted to be number one over every band. I mean, who wouldn't want to have that? You know, but I think, the media definitely did hype it up. And that's what, you know, NME had the British Heavyweight Championship when those two singles were released on, you know, the same week. So,
But anyways, they touch on that. And it's funny because when you look back at it, I would say that Oasis may have won the battle. And granted, even if Blur won that thing, I would say that just far in a way, Oasis probably was a more popular, prominent band at that time overall.
They had They had, Oasis had way more hits in the U.S.
Yes.
I would say from, you know, in where we're from.
Yeah.
In the U.S., like, What's the Story, Morning Glory was just gigantic over here, man.
Oh, it yeah. was just, absolutely.
You know, multiple hits that you heard all the time on the radio. And the only thing we really heard from Blur was song two on the radio. That's all I remember really yeah. hearing of theirs.
But I would say that really Blur won the war because they have since reunited and recorded one album, The Magic Whip, yeah. which I think was from, maybe that's like from a few years ago or 10 years ago or something like that now. Mm-hmm. But now they're set to release something else pretty soon. And then if you really want to go an extra step, Damon Albarn really won the war because, I mean, Gorillaz yeah. has just been wildly successful. He's had his yeah. own career and, yeah, it just, I mean, like, in comparison, Liam Gallagher is just a washed up has been. I hate to say it, like, if you read about the guy's personal life, it sounds like a lot of different child support payments, which suck.
Yeah, yeah, that's wouldn't wish that on anyone. Yeah, it was interesting because even in that documentary, and highly recommend checking it out. I forget what's the full name. It's No Distance Left to Run.
Yeah.
And I was only able to find it on Apple. And it's, you know, $3 to rent. I wish it was on like a streaming service that I pay for.
You but can it watch cool, it on man. Vivo. It's in three parts.
Oh, is it? Yeah. Okay. You know, I thought they did an excellent job. It was really cool to kind of see the chronicling of yeah. of the band. Agreed. So if, and I didn't, and again, I didn't know that much about them, you know, other than up until this album. And then, dude, I probably listened to this album a bunch of times. It was, dude, it was awesome to listen to it again because I forgot how much I actually knew.
Like,
it
oh, seemed yeah.
like,
yeah.
Because, also back in the day, you know, I was the type of listener. I'm like, oh, I'm just going to play song two on repeat because that's awesome. And then I didn't realize how much of the other songs like actually like made it into my brain. I was like, oh, my God. Yeah, I remember this and this yeah, and this. Yeah. Like, man, there's some like really good stuff on there. Very, very different stuff. You know, so I was just, it was such a joy to like just to listen to it again and everything. It was really, really cool, man.
Now, one thing I thought was pretty interesting, and this was near and dear to my heart, but I like the fact that they specifically called out Pavement as a big influence into like their sound and their stylistic yep. change, because they kind of wanted to listen to not the hugely mainstream alternative stuff coming out in the United States. And Pavement was definitely, I mean, if there was an indie band in the 90s, I mean, they were like the yep. archetype for such a thing.
Absolutely. It was Graham Coxon, who was the main guitar player. He just kind of really started getting into, you know, the more American guitar rock. He was yeah. like, you know, the guitarists in America were just doing such interesting things at the time. And yeah, he definitely like specifically cited Pavement and Stephen Malkmus like multiple times in that.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And it's in that other interview that I was reading with Albarn, like he had good things to say about Nirvana, but basically, and I couldn't tell if he was trying to say that what Nirvana prompted after became garbage, because I would agree with that, but like, or I don't know if he was saying like he thought the rest of like the grunge movement was shit, which is really too bad because there's some great records that came out.
Yeah,
and some great bands. You know,
yeah, it was funny because I couldn't kind of tell where he was going with that.
I know. Either.
He kind of saved himself a little bit later with the, okay, yeah, Nirvana. He's like, I'm not talking about Nirvana specifically. They're great. But sort of everything that spawned, right?
Yeah.
And was like, dude, are you talking about STP and Soundgarden and Pearl Jam?
Yeah, yeah.
Because I hope not.
I don't want to go there, but like anything that like the post sort of, like, you know, about the time when this, I don't know, like to me, by the time we were done with high school, everything had turned for the most part.
Suddenly everything had changed.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. I just put my vegetables away.
Yeah, but it was different today.
Yeah. Very different. Yeah. Well, I mean,
it was different for me too, because my fucking fridge is broken.
That's brutal. you know, this did very, very well, but it was a little bit overshadowed also by Radiohead's OK Computer, which came out the same year. Like, and the OK Computer won Best Album. I think
it
won
the Grammy. And how could it not? And
of course. But this is, it's interesting because a lot of people cite the turn of, you know, Kid A, for OK Computer to Kid A. This was also a left turn for these guys too. And it was just, it was funny to hear him talk.
This one did overshadow Pavement's Bright in the Corners though, which also came out in 97, I believe.
There you go. Yeah. But to talk about the, you know, how they were kind of, well, we'll get to it when we get into the tracks, but you know, they didn't think that the record company, the record company and everybody warned them like, hey, you guys are essentially alienating these 15-year-old girls who are your biggest sort of fans.
Yeah.
It seemed like, you know, like that's sort of the group who followed them and everything. And it was funny because even in the documentary, there's this one shot where there's like these doors and windows and Damon's on one side and you see all these teenage girls just like screaming and being crazy and they're all like up against it and everything. And he just like kind of goes up to him and then he just leaves, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I can see that, you know, I don't know, man, what, you know, you got to change and it's risky. It's like a huge risk. But any band, I feel like sometimes that's when bands produce their best work, man.
Yeah, like when their backs are against the wall and they're either gonna fizzle or mm-hmm. you know, lose their record contract completely, and yeah.
Right. Because they even talk about after The Great Escape, there was a lot of like backlash sort of against the band about, you know, who they were and what type of band they were. They were like this middle class pop band, whereas like Oasis was seen as like the working class heroes and stuff like that. And, you know, and again, I don't know enough about the UK and London and everything. But, you know, it seems like there are certain areas where they're sort of, oh, what neighborhood did you come from? Because that kind of defines like who you were. Were you the working class?
Oh, right? Yeah.
Are you the white collar family? Like, and that kind of gets, I think, fairly or unfairly, you know, it gets stuck with you, right? If you're from this area, you represent this kind of people, and that's what your music is identified as. Right?
Well, dude, think about that with like rap in the U.S. and hip hop,
East Coast, West Coast.
But not even that. It's just like
even more.
Like if there's a rapper who came up like fairly affluent, I'm sorry, you just do not put them in the same category as like, you know, the real gangster rappers. It's just they're not the same. It's like it's like, what are you really gonna compare Drake to Nas?
Right.
Even though Drake's Canadian, but still, it's not the same. It just, it seems inauthentic and it seems kind of watered down, you know, which I don't know, like you said, fair or unfair. I just think we kind of do that.
That's the perception.
Yeah. And perception, you know, is reality, as we know. So reality.
Dude, if you say it enough time, it becomes true.
Yeah.
Right? Like just that's it. That's it. So, I don't know, man. I think we can maybe get onto the tracks if you want, my friend.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm good with that. There isn't really a whole lot to talk about in terms of the cover art. It's basically a blurry photo of what looks to be a nurse pushing a stretcher.
That's pretty much what I took it to be. And I guess I think I knew that as a kid growing up, although I didn't, you know, didn't really think about it.
Yeah.
But yeah. So, Grim, track number one, Beetle Bum. This first single of the album, and you know, I did you hear or read about sort of the inspiration?
Oh,
of it?
Yeah.
I found that interesting because I never knew. I don't know if he had a struggle with heroin or anything like that, but I just thought it was pretty interesting that sort of was, you know, kind of taken.
And well, yeah. Between that and his relationship with I'm a little fuzzy on her last name, but Justine Fleischman,
Freshman,
who was the front woman for Elastica, which that must have been kind of a cool thing. Like, you're both in this highly public relationship, head of like two cool bands at the, yeah, you know, yeah. That's, I'm sure that didn't suck. So you're like, yeah, why not just kind of lay around and do a little heroin? And, yeah.
Yeah. But it's just, I guess they didn't, I mean, they talked about it, but they didn't get like overly in depth or, you know, I don't know how long of a thing that was for him, if it's continued to be a thing or like what his
deal is. I wouldn't think so, because you'd find more out. There'd be more out. Like, if there were arrests and, you know, like,
yeah,
it's not like Scott Weiland.
Usually there's a downward spiral.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. So yeah, whatever it was, he must have got out, you know, unscathed. Yeah. But you can tell just in the lyrics of the song. And I like how he says things that are right on the edge, but because in the lyric he says she sucks your thumb, you know, that it sort of lets it pass, even though you know what they're going for.
Well, I thought another interesting lyric that they specifically cited having to do with it, like being about heroin, was like chasing the beetle.
Yeah.
Now, I've never heard beetle, but what they do talk about is like chasing the dragon, which is like, you know, whatever.
Just constantly trying to get that high back.
So,
it's when you're smoke it, I guess. Yeah.
We've never done it, but yes.
No.
But yeah, it's like if you've ever seen the movie Killing Zoe, like there's a specific scene where he's like, oh, here, you should try this. It's called chasing the dragon. It'll make you feel like you've been against a windshield and the windshield wiper is rubbing you back and forth or something like that. Yeah. I'm like, oh wow, that sounds like a lot of fun. Sign me up.
Yeah.
You know, but anyways, I just thought that was, you know, that was pretty interesting. But I don't know, maybe chasing the beetle is sort of another term. Otherwise it is a little stretched, because beetles and dragons in my mind are a little different, but
slightly. I mean, one is made up and the other actually exists, but
yeah,
I mean, just there's so many, just get numb. I mean, there's a lot of basically when she lets me slip away, like there's just a lot of references, I think,
in there. All those. Yeah, definitely. Move on to song number two. Song two.
Didn't know for the life of me what he was saying when I was a kid.
No, either did I. And it was weird, man, because I was like, you know, I've read the lyrics. I'm like, oh, okay, that makes sense. But everybody knows the woohoo,
yeah,
right?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Like, but I thought it was funny. I didn't know this, that they basically, like, he wrote it as like an acoustic demo. Damon did. And it was much slower, but it featured kind of the woohoo. And then Graham Coxon suggested, he was like, oh man, no, let's pump up the speed and play it a lot louder and everything. And that's pretty much what they came up with. And then he was like, yeah, you should take this to the record company and tell them this is what we want to be the single. And they were like blown away when they did that. And the record company was like, oh, this is great.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, we should totally do this. But dude, there's a part of me that I can understand why the execs would actually think that. It's a short song, has energy, has hooks, and the woohoo gets stuck in your head.
Anyone can sing it. And dude, think about it. If they're thinking, what are we going to do to break this band in America? And based on what was popular at that time, like that was, I mean, I would have probably loved Beetlebum as much, but I think that, you know, they got to go for the lowest common denominator of society. So this would have been the choice for that.
Yes,
I think.
Thank God for the low hanging fruit.
Yeah.
All right. Country sad ballad man.
Yeah.
So one thing I always find, especially when I was in my younger days, you know, I would listen to song two a lot. But when you have a song that sometimes you like listen to and repeat, you always catch the beginning of the song like right after it.
Mm-hmm.
And so like I always remember being like so familiar like with
the intro,
this song. Yeah, with the intro to this song and everything. But dude, I always thought it was a fun song, and it to me it it sounds exactly like a country sad ballad, man. Like, that's what the song sounds like to me.
Yeah.
Or sort of a British interpretation of one.
That, I think that's fair. And I don't know. I really like this 3-song run on an album. Like, it is a really good 3-song run. And like, to me, I knew this bit so well that to listen to it again, it was like, even though having heard all of it before many times, it was almost like new again, because these 3 songs were so familiar.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And he does something interesting on this song. He switches back and forth with his vocals. He'll sing like regular and then he goes falsetto almost, yeah. Like, yeah, yeah. He just sings back and forth. I just think that was a fun thing. And it's also got, like, dude, they do some things, I think, production wise on this album that they just hadn't really done before, with all these, like, there's a lot of trippy, like, disorienting sounds, and they do some really weird, some really weird things.
Yeah. And a lot of weird stuff with the guitar, which once I read that, I was like, I can honestly hear that, you know, listening to Pavement, which is one of my favorite bands. It makes, right. You can really make the connection. Well, especially once you read it, you're like, I get it now. Because right. I think by the time Pavement got to Brighten the Corners, they were still doing some weird sounds, but they did a lot more of it in the albums, I think, leading up to even Brighten the Corners.
Certainly.
Yeah. Like Wowie Zowie and
Wowie Zowie.
Crooked Rain, LA's Desert Origins. That's a special edition.
So many good ones.
Yeah.
All right, Grim. We get to the track. Track number 4, M.O.R. More. No. I found that, you know, this was the 4th single on the album. And
I can see why this would be a good single.
Right. Which they reference reference the lyrics in the song. Does stand for middle of the road.
Yeah.
Middle of the road. What I didn't know, and I mentioned this to you, and I didn't really notice anything, but like the chord progression, they borrowed it from David Bowie's.
Yeah.
Boys Keep Swinging, from 2 songs, Boys Keep Swinging and Fantastic Voyage, because Bowie and Brian Eno, which is an interesting experiment. Basically, on the same album, they just recorded 2 songs with the same chord progression, which I don't know if I've ever heard of that before. I mean, it seems like, I guess, a fun
thing to do. Yeah, it's kind of cool. Like, this is your basis. What are you going to come up with versus what I came up with?
Right.
You know?
Right.
And yeah, I like the experiment. I listened to both of those songs. I don't know about both of them, but I know the ones on Lodger, which I think is part of the
Berlin trilogy. They are both on Lodger. They are.
I didn't hear whatever Eno did with them. But go on about the bit. Well, okay. So yeah, the chord progression. And I did hear it when I listened to Bowie, but it's just basically, it starts. It's just sort of that bit, right. which is the, in slight differences, I guess, in like speed, beats per right. minute, and maybe how long they hold each of those chords, but I could definitely hear it when I listened to the 2 Bowie songs. And then I heard it again because I guess they did the same thing when they did Fantastic Voyage by Coolio.
I think you're shit. Dude, it was funny, man, because when I saw Fantastic Voyage, I was like,
you were
I was like, wait a minute. It, like, it took me a second. I was wait. What are you guys talking about?
I am not.
I don't hear it.
I know I might need to re-listen.
I do not hold myself as a music aficionado, but I was like, man, I'm not picking that. I'm not picking it up.
Yeah.
But anyways, there was a legal intervention, and however it was resolved, I don't know. But
they Bowie just had and, to give him credit,
or give him credit,
yeah,
right.
Which so. I get. I mean, I can get them being credited, but I just do that. If it becomes a money thing, it's kind of like, dude, fuck. Like, come on, really? Like, it was cool when you guys did it, but if anyone else wants to jump on, like, you don't get to try this.
Right, right, yeah.
Because I'm sure they were both really hurting at that point.
Not David. Not David. So, track number 5, On Your Own.
Now, was On Your Own a single? Because that seems
it was the third single.
Okay, because that to me seems like it would also have been a good single.
Yeah. Now, they used a Roland TR-606 Dramatic.
Mm-hmm. That's like that was like a cheaper cousin to the 808.
The 808.
The one that I have.
Is there a 707?
Yep.
So did they just keep going?
I think nothing after the 909.
Okay.
But whatever. Yeah. But
was it a 1010?
No. Okay. I think on mine, you were able to get this firmware update and you could actually get the 606 samples. And they're just a little like crunchier, which I love. I think it sounds great. And sometimes the cheaper those drum machines, almost like the better the sound, because it just got... You know, they like in order to make it work, they just digitally like made the samples less and less quality, which gave it this crunch, you know?
Sure. Yeah. So. Yeah. Yeah. No, this one definitely has sort of a single feel. Mm-hmm. Just the way the guitar, the drums, the way he sings to it and everything. Like I can definitely feel like this song is one that the crowd really gets into, and like it just has like those parts where he really emphasizes certain words that people would just like really gravitate to wanting to sing along with and everything.
Yeah. So. And it's probably one that's more for fans, because I mean any asshole can go woohoo. Yes. Which I wouldn't be surprised if like they refuse to play that nowadays.
Yeah, I could see that. Yeah. Yeah. It would be interesting to look up, you know, when they've played, you know, their most recent concerts. Yeah. What their set lists are. Because, dude, certain bands, and it's great that certain bands are able to get past that hit that broke them. Like, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, dude, Radiohead got to the point where they're like, yeah, we're not playing Creep. And then now it's to the point where I've seen Radiohead a few times, and they only, you know, they'll play maybe one or two songs off OK Computer. Like, it's not like,
oh yeah,
you know, it's just jam packed with that, you know? So it is cool when they can, you know, play some of the deeper cuts and the fans still love them like just as much. Right.
Well, yeah. True fans, bro. True fans.
Super fans. All right, Grim, track number 6, Theme from Retro. I don't know what retro is, but it does sound like it could be a theme from it.
Yeah. It's kind of their like experimental sort of.
Sounds like a bad trip, man. It like there's certain sounds and things in it that actually I'm like, man, I hear a lot of Gorillaz.
Oh, absolutely. Right? Dude, that on this one and the same thing with I'm Just a Killer for Your Love. Just the way it sounds. Mm-hmm. I know what you mean. Yeah. Like you definitely, I'm glad you said that, because there was a couple spots in the album where it's like you do feel like it's the predecessor.
Absolutely. Dude, it just sounds very like almost dystopian, like, and like the organ. The organ sound is really just kind of like what sort of accentuates that sort of feeling and emotion.
Yeah, really
pretty good shit. Exploring the space. Grim, track number 7, You're So Great. Well, this was cool because, well, it's Graham Coxon. It's just like, it's just him, you know? It's just him like playing acoustic and everything. And it's really nice, man. Like, I just, it's... it reminds me of, like, it has such an old, like, demo feel to it and everything. Like, his vocals sound a little, like, nothing's polished about the song or anything. What it actually really reminds me of is almost like something the Flaming Lips would do.
Oh, I was going to say Spoon, but yeah.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah. Okay. Okay. I can buy that, too.
My love. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I could definitely get on board with that. Uh-huh. Yeah, it just has this sort of rough, kind of like just the unpolished feel of like a demo, but man, I really dig it.
Yeah, I know. Cool. It is cool, and I think it kind of fits in there nicely with everything, because it still has like the sound and kind of the main sensibility of like what the band I think would do or had done or was thinking about doing.
Definitely. All right, Grim. Track number 8.
Death of a Party.
Of a Party.
Now this is, I feel like this is kind of dark, this is like, lyrically, but I...
Oh.
I love
dark lyrically, musically.
Oh, yeah, I love it. I love it musically. But lyrically, I mean, yeah, he says something about like just hang himself at another party or something.
Dude, go to another party and hang myself gently on the shelf. Like, dude, I feel like this song is like, it's like theme from Retro's Cousin or something. Like it had, like it's, you know, like it, they both have similar feels to me.
Yeah, I agree. I think this one's a little more approachable because it has,
yes,
it has like a solid lyric base and,
it does.
And I don't know I mean, how can you know exactly what it's about? But just in thinking about it and where they were and sort of watching a bit of that documentary, I feel like it's sort of just the exhaustion of being burnt out by, like, the fame machine.
Absolutely. The fame, celebrity lifestyle. It's like, oh, sweet. Yeah. Even if you want to be literal about it, it's like, oh, sweet. Let's go to another party. I got to hang out with these people. I got to put on a smile. I mean, dude, look, there's obviously a lot of benefits that come to being, you know, famous and having, you know, this sort of status. But even in that documentary, one thing I noticed is like, you know, people are always going up to the guys wanting their picture. Yeah. And it's just like, fuck, man, that would get annoying after a while. It's like, okay, cool, man. Cool. We'll do it again, you know, and let me put on that smile. You know,
I think I would figure out how to like make it so I could move my eyes apart and do that at every picture. So it's just like, I mean? People can do that.
It's hard. I read this thing where
kind of like this.
Yeah.
Can you do that?
No.
A lot of people have trouble just moving one finger like this.
Oh, yeah, I can spock it.
No. You got to adjust your pinky.
Can you shock it?
Well, yeah, that's easy.
Of course. Yeah, it's easy.
Okay. Anyway,
noon and night. But dude, that was one thing that I read about Radiohead. This was back before cell phones and stuff. Like they'd have fans come up and want to take pictures of them and everything. So like they had a thing, I guess, within the band where they would purposely cut their heads off so you couldn't tell it was them. Imagine like getting your picture taken with them, being so excited, getting your photo developed and everybody's heads are cut off. Dude, that's kind of awesome, isn't it?
It's really funny.
All right, track number 9. Chinese Bombs. Yeah, I heard it's the bomb and you got it going on. Give me some of your thug bashing, Grim. This is a pretty raw, in-your-face rock song.
It's like punk roots kind of a song.
Yes, definitely. And I mean, it's a minute and 25 seconds.
Yeah.
So it's just like get in and get out. We're going to punch you in the face, kick you in the balls, and then we're going to move on to the next one. And I feel like this is almost just like a fuck off song where they were just kind of like in the studio. They're like, hey, let's just play something crazy and fun and angry. And it doesn't have to go anywhere. It doesn't have to be anything. It's just this quick little bling. And then, all right, we're good. We're like not going to try to make it into some like, you know, let's put all these transitions in and make it like just a full, you know, let's flesh it out. It just seems like something fun that they would play. At least, you know, I could see that. I think it would be fun to play. Track number 10. I'm just a killer. For your love. I'm just a killer for your love.
I'm just a killer for your love. Now, this is also kind of dark. Your love. And,
I'm just a killer.
Kind of has like that, what would remind me of some Gorillaz sound and feel also. But again, it's one of my favorite ones on the song, on the album, just because it's, I don't know, I like it when bands sort of do stuff that's palatable, but a little weird.
Yeah, yeah. This is one of those songs where I kind of mentioned earlier that sort of, you know, Nirvana tried to do with In Utero, like, man, we're going to make some stuff that's kind of like messed up.
Uncomfortable.
Yeah. And I feel like that's sort of what this is. Like, I get done listening to the song and I'm kind of like, man, I think at least go wash my hands because I'm feeling a little dirty. It just has that mood to it, man.
Filthy dude with a pH.
Then we go to track number 11. Look inside America.
Good morning, Lafayette. Drink Pepsi. It's good for energy.
I can only assume this was written like during a tour.
Yeah.
Or something.
Probably. Yeah. Well, in the documentary, they talk about, now this was in, I believe, like 92-ish or something. Okay. They were in debt and they went on this US tour and they talked about, and they were just like, I mean, fucking kids at that point. And they were just like
miserable, right?
They're on the bus and getting hammered and fighting each other and just like, yeah, just everything. So at this time though, I'm sure they had toured the US, you know, multiple times, but they definitely got a good look at it. And it's always interesting to hear other people's perspective of what it's like in the US who don't live in the US.
Oh, I know. And it's a common thing because I have an album by a band called The Libertines, and it's a little later than this, but it would be like within the, or probably within 10 years of this. And dude, they have a song on there called Radio America. And I don't know. It's just this sort of, I do enjoy it with a band that's not American, but singing about America, because it's weird being here and having been here the whole time. But if you weren't here the whole time, I'm sure you're like, what the fuck is going on in this place?
Yeah, you know, it's nice when people will hold up the mirror sometimes. But I mean, he specifically says or sings like, I'm looking for America with its kooky nights and suicide, where the TV says it's all right because everybody's strung out on something or other, right?
Yeah, that's
right?
A good line.
And it's like, I was just like, yeah, that makes a lot of sense, man.
Now, since we're in talking about locations, one thing I did want to touch on briefly that I thought was really cool was that part of this album was recorded in Iceland. And apparently Albarn has had a home in Iceland for some time, and he actually has dual citizenship now.
Dude, that's awesome, man.
Yeah.
Dude, that would be like, if you want to go get like just kind of space out.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, he has a house there. He definitely has a house. It's in Reykjavik. He's got a house there. And I think they wanted to get away from like the Brit pop scene and everything.
Yeah. They should come to America.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, look inside.
Go to L.A.
Oh, that's great. I think they said that he mostly recorded vocals and stuff there. But yeah, man, if you need a place where you need to get away, especially, I mean, now it's just like a tourist trap and everybody's going there. But in whatever, 96, 97, it certainly wasn't what it is, you know, now,
because such
a destination.
My guess is that I think a lot of people from the U.S. probably started going over before. It was probably like more of a European thing.
Yeah,
because it's just closer and they would know about it, whereas, you know, we wouldn't.
No,
we still got fooled by Leif Erikson. We're going to Greenland because we thought that was the nice one.
Exactly, man. Tricky. All right, Grim. Track number 12. Strange News from Another Star.
say.
This is a really nice track. I don't know if that's a Hammond organ. Is that a Hammond organ? And I'm not sure if it is or not, but it just sounds really, really nice, man. And
Yep, it is.
It is cool. And the production of this track is really nice. Like, his vocals are very crisp. The acoustic guitar is. It just has this really cool kind of dreamy feel to it, man. I really mm-hmm. dig it a lot. That's what I gotta say.
Dude, I think it's Damon Albarn. But I was watching last night, I was looking around and I was watching a couple different things that I found as like a Blur documentary.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to say there was one clip of him playing the piano. Mm-hmm. And he's like very good. I mean, like, yeah. Was playing classical stuff yeah. on there, like, you know.
I can see him being quite really good.
If I'm not mistaken. But I was really, because you knew the guy could play things, right? Like, that wasn't.
Seems like he can play mostly anything, probably.
Yeah, that yeah. wasn't an issue. But, I mean, to hear the level at which he was playing and just sitting there dicking around, I was kind of like, wow, that's okay. Because I want to yeah. say in the documentary, they were going back to the school that him and Graham Coxon had met at. Yeah. And he saw this place and he was like, this was where I would go the most because this was like a rehearsal room and started playing. And you were just like, ooh, I guess so.
Dude, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. Track number 13. Moving on. I really like the riff at the beginning of this track, man. It's just, yeah. it's pretty cool. You know, it kind of sounds like, you know, they recorded it in a room with like the mic, like really far away or something. And then it punches in and it's just like, it's like all of a sudden we're right here.
I know
it's
that's, cool. that's, I really like using space like that. And it's funny cause it's one of those things that can be almost subtle enough to where you don't even realize it until all of a sudden it's that much better, you know?
Right, right. You're like, oh, okay, okay. And then it's like, ooh, okay, here we are. Dude, this song is, I just think it's a good rock song. I mean, it's got a lot of, there's a lot of synth and fuzz going on. Dude, another thing they do in this album too that I really like is just the use of background vocals and harmonies.
Yeah.
You know, it's not crazy and like overly prevalent, but they really pick some nice spots, kind of where they do it and everything. And I almost feel like that's a lost art. I feel like I don't notice it as much in sort of kind of like, I guess, you know, modern rock. Yes. So yeah, I dig this song. And then Grim, we have Essex Dogs. Now on the American, here's the thing. One thing on the American CD version, this track is actually 11 minutes and 24 seconds. Currently on streaming, I have it as 8 minutes and 10. And that's because they put the song Dance Hall in between Essex Dogs and the interlude. Right now, Essex Dogs, it's got the track.
The interlude is just that ending sort of riff they have, right?
Exactly. Okay. But then the song Dance Hall, they put sort of as a hidden track. And it's funny, man, because, dude, it's such a 90s thing to do. Like, oh, yeah, we're going to have hidden tracks.
Oh, yeah.
And, like, it's going to go quiet for, like, that was. And I don't want to say it was like overdone and overplayed because it was always fun, especially when you were a kid. You couldn't.
You don't know.
You just didn't know,
but it was kind of better just to wait and see what happened.
Yeah. So
it's like MacGruber said, you know, there's winging it and then there's just seeing what happens. We're going to see what happens.
See what happens. Yes, we are, Larry. Yeah. But dude, even the beginning of the song, man, it sounds like a bad trip. Like it's like, to me, it sounds like it's like a digitized version of a, motorcycle like throttling up and down or something.
Because I was going to comment on that. So I feel like they must have taken a sample Because there's the whatever sample they use has like a click or some sort of a percussive bit at the end of it. And if you take that sample and whatever, it just loops it over, you're going to get that click at a certain rate that corresponds with whatever pitch. And then if you shift that pitch up, the click goes faster because the pitch is now, it's a shortened amount of time. And so that I like that. I was really, when I listened to that, I was like, oh, I would really love to know where they got whatever sample they used for
whatever
this.
Whatever it is.
Yeah, it's kind of, I like what it's doing.
Right. Yeah, it is pretty cool. Yeah, I think that pretty much brings us to the end, Grim.
It does.
Yeah. So, dude, what's your favorite track? Have we talked? Beetleblum. All right. Yeah, I'm probably going to be... Oh, man, it's tough. Dude, I like On Your Own a lot. Dude, I like You're So Great, man, which is kind of funny because it's like the only one Damon, like, you know, I mean, it's not his. Man, yeah. Dude, Look Inside America is pretty great, though. I kind of like that one a lot. Yeah.
I just... to me, it's Beetlebum or Country Sad Ballad, man.
Yeah. Yeah,
I mean, I could never get away from Beetlebum. And one thing I did want to say about Beetlebum, too. Mm-hmm. So I read where several people, when they initially reviewed it, said that it was very much like a Beatles tribute kind of song.
Yeah,
I can see that, though, because you know what the end of it reminds me of when they just have all those sounds kind of coming? Dude, it reminds me of the end of I Am the Walrus. When they just have all those weird sounds and shit coming in at the end.
Sure.
I Am the Walrus.
Yeah. V.I. Lennon. Yeah. Okay. Well, because I think one critic or someone said that it's basically they took what the Beatles did with like the White Album and they went
condensed
like
it every, to 5 minutes.
To 5 minutes. And I was like
it's that, a little, yeah. Where's the part that references Good Night?
Yeah, exactly.
Why isn't that getting any love?
Good night. All right, time for the scratches, Grim. Time for the scratches.
I think since this album had such sentimental warmth and wonderfulness for you, I feel like you must scratch first with what I don't know. Maybe a needle, because apparently that was a thing for a minute then.
Yeah. Well, yeah, right. Yeah, definitely was. So I've been going back and forth between two tracks, but you kind of almost talked me out of what I was initially going to scratch. So I'm going to go back to what my second track was. I am going to scratch Theme from Retro.
Okay.
Because one, it's really out there. It, you know, and hey, I don't mind songs are out there. It sounds like a bad trip. Again, it does have a lot of Gorilla stuff, which I like. But I feel like there's a lot. Yeah. I feel like there's a lot of similarities in the feel in everything of the song between that and Death of a Party. But I like where Death of
Essex Dogs to a degree.
And Essex Dogs. Sure. Yeah. But I like where Death of a Party goes.
Yeah.
Like, and that's the thing, how it becomes more of a melodic song, I guess.
Yeah.
So that's where I would have to go. Theme from Retro.
Okay.
What do you got, Grim?
I am going to go with. Because, as I listened to it.
Overtime.
Yeah, there was just no way that couldn't be the one I would cut.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. All right. OT Zone?
OT Zone, my man.
All right, Grim. Dude, Essex Dogs. The only reason I didn't that was going to be my first scratch. The reason I jumped and went up to a Theme from Retro is I like the way I do like the intro and it sounds so interesting and unique and everything. I will say again, the song, it's 8 minutes and 10 seconds. Obviously, it's the first two-thirds of it is like this kind of poetic spoken word kind of thing, and that's fine.
It's like Blur was listening to Tom Waits.
That's cool, you know, but it's just cool. Not like it's not something I don't know, I really care for. Yeah. And you know, if you're gonna put it anywhere, like this is where you're gonna put it.
Yeah.
Otherwise, if this would have been put anywhere else in the album, it would have been easily the first scratch. But yeah, it's just now I haven't listened to Dance Hall, so I feel like maybe the CD version, maybe Dance Hall could save it. I don't know. It's probably not like good Modest Mouse's Dance Hall, but
God, it's gonna it could be. One.
I don't know, man.
Okay.
So, all right. So you got an OT zone filler?
Yeah, not really one I would want to pick, but the other stuff works for me so much in the album. You might throw it out, and if you do, that's fine, but you're so great. Sad drunk Polly,
sleeping really late. Oh, okay. Wow. Just any other reason? Just, you know.
I mean, there's a lot about it that I like, and granted, this is secondary scratching, so just let's clarify that and throw it out on the table here. This was not the first one. This is a double if you had to, but it's just, it's a nice song, but it's one that I could skip if, you know.
Okay.
If my That's hand fair, was man. Forced.
If your hand was forced.
So I think that kind of wraps it up, dude.
It does. That wraps it up. Blur.
Tell us what you would scratch.
Blur.
When you go ahead and
like and subscribe and comment below.
Exactly. All right, everyone. Thanks for watching. We'll see you on the next time.
Peace.
Time to go. The Dude
Scratch a Track is produced by the Dude and Grim. Additional music provided by Moore and the Tings. Copyright 2023. The Dude and Grim Show.